Is there anything you would have done differently?
We reported a true story.
Our colleague Brian Williams is back in Kuwait City tonight after a close call in the skies over Iraq.
Controversial Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh and questions about Kavanaugh's drinking in the past.
Sean Hannity, come on up, Sean Hannity.
Today, Andrew Cuomo is having a moment.
Hi, I'm Chris Starwalt.
And I'm Aliana Johnson.
Welcome to L Ink Stained Retros, where we break down what's going wrong and, in fact, what is going right with the American news media. Eliana Johnson, in a real preppy sweater today. How much more did you think about your look knowing that we were being recorded?
I actually didn't because if I had, it was so hot last week that I ended up in my T-shirt or like my, you know, plain white tee. I didn't think about it at all, but it's much cooler in here, so I don't have to take my sweater off. And I can wear my stylish sweater.
Yeah. It's
and
cooler.
I don't have to reveal my white tank top underneath.
You look like, and with this like leatherish coat, leather looking coat.
It is not leather looking.
Well, it looks like it could be a couch, a fine couch in a men's club somewhere.
No.
But with that sweater and that jacket and those jeans, you could be on your way to like a, what would the right concert?
It's actually so mom.
It's no,
this
it's
is
very
so
90s.
Mom
it's
attire.
Very 90s. You could be on your way to watch, what was the one they did in Seattle with Winona Ryder? What's that movie? Oh, you're younger than I am, but listeners over 40 will recall, like Ethan Hawke. You're on your way to an
Ethan
Hawke movie. Some kind as this is.
What movie is that? Reality Bites?
Reality Bites. You look like you're on your way to a screening of Reality Bites and too cool to hang out with me.
I think it's a very mom fit.
Well, you're a mom.
Yeah, I know. All right, Chris and I were saying that we have a wealth of riches this week.
And we should also say that someone, I don't know who uses the studio at AEI other than us, but it smells.
They smoked a brisket in here.
It smells like wood smoke and grease in here, and I feel seen and appreciated.
Okay, let's get to our front page. We have first, Chris, ding, ding, ding. The Justice Department is reviewing classified documents found in not one, but two, I would say, offices, Biden offices, except for that the second batch of classified documents were found in Biden's Wilmington garage. And Biden has just said before we went to air, quote, my Corvette is in a locked garage.
I bet that's right.
So the classified documents were stored alongside his Corvette.
You know my favorite Biden is the Onion Biden, the Uncle Joe dirtbag Biden. And the sentence, my Corvette is in a locked garage, is in keeping with that.
So this is
a great story to dissect from how stories come to be. Because we got to see it in real time. And it was in a compressed timeline because of the way that it went. But here's my assumption, and check my thinking.
Okay. I always do.
You do. And I rely on that. The Justice Department, in analyzing its case against Donald Trump, must have said, is Joe Biden got anything on this? Is there any? Well, who else, right? Because before you would want to bring a charge against Trump or anybody in his orbit, you wouldn't want to do it and then have it be found later. Does this strike you as that, or does this strike you as something else?
That strikes me as entirely plausible. And what I find most interesting, galling about the coverage is, first of all, these documents were found November 2nd, a week ahead of the midterm elections. So now the story can be told. Now we can all learn about it.
I've shared the screen grab. Maybe we can put it in our newsletter, Hi El Retros. But at 7:35 p.m. on what day was it that it broke?
I don't know.
Whatever day this
Two
week.
Days, I would say January 10th, I'm going to guess.
9th or 10th.
No, it has to be the 9th.
So at 7:31 p.m., Washington Post news alert.
Yeah.
At 7:34 p.m., Washington New York Times news alert. So the Justice Department went to the Post. Or the Biden White House went to the Post. Who went to the Post?
Well, CBS News broke the original story.
Oh, really?
That these existed? They did. CBS News had the original story.
So who went to CBS?
Somebody teed it up for them.
Yeah.
And
by the way, we should say, You can do a print exclusive. So this is where I want to take listeners. So when you have this story, it's bad for you. But my question is, do you think it was the Justice Department or do you think it was the White House?
The Justice Department.
Okay, so you're at the Justice Department. You have a story that's bad for you or bad for your team. It mitigates the attack on the other side because of it muddies the waters around Donald Trump and his documents. And it's just a mistake, right? Even if Donald Trump had never stolen or whatever he did with the papers, even if he had never Sandy Bergered a bunch of papers from the White House, this would still not be a good look. But you are getting ahead of it, right? Because you do get to control when and how, as you say, not the week before the election, but now you do get to control. So you can have a TV exclusive. You can say to CBS, we have a big story for you. We're briefing against interest and we're giving it to you. Is it exclusive? Says CBS News. And they could say, television exclusive. You've got the broadcast exclusive on this, but we're going to give the print exclusive to the Washington Post and the New York Times at the same time, or we give it to the Post and then give it to the Times. That's the strategy behind this kind of stuff. And it was really interesting to see in my inbox just like how that little dance plays out.
As you said, because somebody is going to them and providing all the context that makes Biden look better in this scenario, you know, it is up to the reporter to decide whether that context is meaningful or not. But we've totally seen all the reports run with the context provided by the Biden team.
Where Colin found the great thing from CNN.
So I'm going to read. So this is the CNN tweet, but this has been on screen for them. I saw it just this morning. And literally, there's nothing that the White House or the Justice Department would have changed about this. It says, the tweet is from CNN Politics. There are clear distinctions between the two classified documents cases involving President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump. And then it's split into two. We'll include the tweet in our newsletter. Classified documents found. On the one hand, Joe Biden, his picture. Under 12 total. Some top secret. Cooperating. Lawyers found and alerted archives. And then there's a very menacing picture of Donald Trump.
To be fair, that is Donald Trump's official presidential portrait.
And
that is his choice.
And it says 160 plus secret as opposed to under 12, which that is already now increased because they found another batch. 60 top secret, which is obviously worse than some top secret. Like, they don't even know how many. And then under investigation for obstruction. And that seems to me the only actual distinction here is that, like, the Biden people willingly handed these over and the Trump people wanted to hold on to them. But anyways, FBI search after ignored subpoena.
And I'm also willing to believe, by the way, and yes, that is true. By the way, what is a gold checkmark? Is that a new Twitter status?
No idea.
Not people.
Producer Colin has it.
Producer Colin says it's for non-human publications. When does Inkstained Wretches get a gold check?
Yeah, we need that.
Hey, Elon Musk, thanks for nothing. As soon as we get a Twitter account, we demand a gold check mark to be put on it. We'll pay extra. So the way that CNN played it and the way that the New York Times.
That's how every news outlet played it.
And the Washington Post played it.
In the mainstream.
Was before you think about this, know that this is okay, right? So it was like pre-figure. Like, I know what you're thinking, that this is bad and that it's the same as Donald Trump, but it's not. So there was a pre-butting of this.
Totally.
That by the way, Donald Trump didn't have because, of course, he didn't release the documents. Like, he could have done some of that, too. But, of course, predictably, on the other side and at Fox and elsewhere, it is like, well. I see it's exactly the same. And my question is, how long until we are told that Hunter Biden's genitalia pictures are in the documents?
Yeah.
How long until we're told that the Kraken is really in these documents? How long until we find out that the pictures of Vladimir Zelensky making out with Joe Biden are just that's all. It was all next to the Corvette. It's all answer the question.
Well, and the documents are Russian disinformation. This whole thing was actually a Russian disinfo op. That's coming soon.
That's right. So anyway, so that was a great for me. if you want a microcosm of how the siloed partisan media works and how the spin cycle goes, that was a great snapshot.
All right, up next,
my Corvette we have, is in a locked garage.
Yeah.
That may be.
Yeah.
Should
that be the tagline for our show?
That's fantastic.
Okay. Up next, Chris, we recorded Thursday last week, and then over the weekend, all of this McCarthy speaker drama went down, and the coverage was interesting.
The coverage was much of the coverage was good, and of course, I was right. We were right. That's what's important here. I think that's what people have to take away from this is that our estimations were correct, and that
I don't even remember. What did we say?
That it would take forever. In my mind, McCarthy never stopped being the most likely person to be speaker. It got real squeezy for a minute on Thursday into Friday of last week. It was real close. And at any moment, the old bulls could have seemingly rolled up the rug and said, Kevin, you're done. You have to go away. But then, of course, there was new levels of pandering to be pandered. But the coverage, we were very right about the coverage.
Should we play the CNN clip that captured the tone and tenor of a lot of the coverage in the mainstream, and then we'll get to Fox/right wing, but let's play the CNN clip.
Now we are at the moment where the numbers are creating the pressure. Who's the one or two people who are going to keep us here over the weekend?
Let's listen to Kim.
We'll come back tonight, and I believe at that time we'll have the votes to finish this once and for all. It just reminds me of what my father always told me. It's not how you start, it's how you finish. And now we have to finish for the American public.
Oh, for Christ's sake.
Okay.
So whoever that was not a fan of Kevin McCarthy.
But that sort of sneering contempt, both for the right-wing holdouts and for McCarthy himself, like, seeped through to all of the coverage in the mainstream. Like, the hour before McCarthy actually was elected, between, like, 11 and 12:30 on CNN.
You were watching.
It was visceral. It was visceral. And it was all like, you know, the supposedly the down the line CNN reporters. And my thought was just like, to the extent that Chris Licht has tried to say, we're going to report the news and not be sneering, contemptuous partisans, like, this is a fail.
The greatest failure surrounding this story was the amount of coverage, right? And the last week we made fun of how historic it was. Historic! It's never happened before. Can you believe it? Oh, my. It was the Jonah Goldberg, peace be upon him, referred to it as, I believe, the McCarthy Dameron. The huge questions abound around this important thing. And you're like, no. They have a 5-seat majority in the House. Doesn't matter. They could make Mary Poppins the Speaker of the House, and they're not going to do anything, right? This is about optics and whatever. And look, well, okay, let's do listen to what Tucker Carlson had to say about his colleague, Ben Domenech.
The way that they've gone about trying to achieve these demands has resulted in essentially this terrorist standoff between them and the overwhelming majority of people in their conference.
Oh, they're so excitable. Are you following this? The failure to make it super easy and simple for Kevin McCarthy is extremism, declares Nicole Wallace. It's just embarrassing, says Ryan Zinke. It's pornography, says another. Poor old Charlie Sykes got so upset watching the proceedings that he compared a vote in Congress to an exploding hand grenade. There was smoke and fire and shrapnel and the shrieking of the dying calling out for their mothers because some people would not vote for Kevin McCarthy. That's what it was like in there, ladies and gentlemen. Some of us will never recover.
It is amazing how much shooting inside the tent is allowed over there now when I remember the Ailes dictum was we shoot out, not in.
We didn't say shoot. Micturating.
What was it?
Making
Pick,
water.
Piss,
yes,
yeah.
Yes. Well, it is a family podcast. But look, you can't call your colleague a buffoon on the same network. You can't do it. It's not good.
Well,
it's
you,
not right.
You can, apparently.
Well, at Fox, you can do anything. Right. And that's if you're a big enough name, you can do whatever you want. And that's the problem. So I guess what I would say is, first of all, calm down. all of these people should calm down. And this is how this happens. it's on television, so we watch. It's there's video of it. There's something happening, and we can watch it and we can cover it.
It was kind of interesting to watch the video.
It was fascinating when what's his name, Rogers from Kentucky.
It was interesting.
Oh, it was like a Renaissance painting, yeah. Right? The many trials of Kevin McCarthy and all that stuff. It was totally interesting to watch, but it wasn't important. Does that difference make sense to
yes.
you?
Okay. I can comprehend that difference.
I think that was where we missed. We should have taken this. I think this was a good thing to make sport of and a good thing to have fun with. Not a good thing to be serious about. Not a good thing to get upset about.
There was a very interesting article in the New York Times, and I do feel like this article has been written before, mm-hmm. but I have strong views about it. I'm sure you'll be shocked to hear. But the headline in the New York Times was, "Can Ron DeSantis Avoid Meeting the Press?"
By Michael Grimbaum.
Yes. And I just want to read a little bit about it, because the article basically concludes in a way that... Michael Grimbaum agrees with me. But anyhow, you know, DeSantis doesn't sit down for mainstream media interviews. He does not engage with the mainstream media.
And we talked about this contemporaneous to the great piece in The Atlantic that Dexter Filkins wrote about Ron DeSantis. And somebody wrote the piece, maybe it was Politico, about Republicans circumventing.
Oh, right. That's what I'm thinking of. It was all Republicans, but using DeSantis as a hook. Yeah. So Grimbaum writes, "His success is an ominous sign for the usual rules of engagement between politicians and the press as another nationwide election looms. Presidential candidates typically endure media scrutiny in exchange for the megaphone and influence of mainstream outlets. But in an intensely partisan choose-your-own-news era, the traditional calculus may have shifted." And I totally agree with that. Like, there's very little to be gained for DeSantis from engaging with news outlets that, from his vantage point, he doesn't believe treat him fairly. And much like, you know, Trump did this through Twitter, but when he wants a megaphone, he can get one, and he doesn't need to engage. I don't think he needs to engage
Trump
with these guys.
Or DeSantis?
DeSantis.
Oh.
But Trump did it through Twitter. You know, when he wanted to get his message out, he could tweet. And the press would cover his tweets. He enjoyed right. sitting down with the mainstream. He did it because he also enjoyed having them as a foil. DeSantis does it. He's almost like the negative of that. I want to say the mirror image, but he's not. He's like the negative of it, where
the obverse.
He makes the media the enemy, but like through no engagement.
Here's a very telling paragraph. A top DeSantis communications aide, Christina Pushaw, which is very close to Pshaw, which is a good name for a spokesperson, Pshaw, has articulated the governor's view of the news media in harsh terms. Quote, "They hate you. They hate us. They hate everything we stand for. And I believe they hate this country," she said in a speech in September referring to the media. So it's casual. It's casual.
And that's like a political message that they're driving, and they don't need the and I think their lack of engagement and like clubbiness with the mainstream is their way of driving that message.
I think the challenge that Ron DeSantis continues to have is that if all the people who liked him and want him to be the Republican nominee were visible, he would be in big trouble, because in order for him to be palatable to the reflexively, oh, by the way,
what
I meant to ask you, did you read the back and forth between David Brooks and Brett Stevens that they ran in the Times?
No.
I recommend it. I'll find it. Well, it kind of is. And it's about their recollections of what they learned over the past 30 years in the conservative movement and how things have changed.
Okay.
And it's quite interesting and revealing. And I do appreciate with both of them a lot of self-awareness, right? One of the things that when you start reading something like that, you go, uh-oh, is this going to be
okay, so we'll link that, but where were you going?
So the point being, the traditional conservative, oh, I'm going to take one more discursion, and then we're coming right back.
Then I'm going to shove you back onto
back onto Ron DeSantis, Pshaw. One of the big successes of the speakership coverage was they did not refer to the anti-McCarthy people as conservative. Did you notice that?
100%. No, CNN had a chyron calling them extremists.
Yeah, and it's great because one of my crusades, it's in my book, it's one of the things that I have talked about for a long time, is that we need an updated political nomenclature. There are, who is the most conservative? Thomas Massey is very conservative. He's a libertarian. He's beyond conservative. He's a conservative libertarian. And Chip Roy, you can say, Chip Roy is a conservative, right? There is an ideological consistency in his beliefs. But so would you say, like, is Liz Cheney a conservative?
Yeah.
Yeah. Liz Cheney's a conservative. Her views, her policy views are conservative. Is Lauren Boebert a conservative? I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't know. Certainly, how about Josh Hawley in the Senate?
I would say those are more pop. They're
populist, more populist, national. And yes. So I say nationalist or just right wing. You can just say right wing. But we're moving away from it. And I want to thank the press for this move. And I think this has been a good part of it, which is there are progressives. There are liberals. There are conservatives. There are nationalists. But you can't. They're not the same thing. And you can't just lump them together. So I thought that was good. Anyway.
Okay, but like, when are we ever going to see a Chyron, like, on CNN, Democratic extremists?
Well, on CNN, we'll see where CNN ends
up. Are they ever going to get that treatment?
We'll see. They've made
some
moves.
We're waiting, Chris Licht.
But as you say,
for the equal treatment,
not done. But anyway, in their conversation about where conservatism is and where the right is, it was very interesting. Ron DeSantis would be, if you could take a stealth poll of those kinds of Republicans, and so I don't know if Bret Stephens is still a Republican or whatever, but if you could take sort of traditional center-right people, they would love to have Ron DeSantis. You know why?
Why?
Because he's not Donald Trump. That's why they would love to have Ron DeSantis. So if all of the big money donors and intellectuals who would prefer Ron DeSantis came out and said, we love Ron DeSantis, this is great, it would ruin Ron DeSantis' right. candidacy, because then he would just get Scott Walker'd, right? Then it would just be, oh, I don't know. So the hatred of Ron DeSantis in the press is a necessary component of Ron DeSantis' presidential campaign. In order to convince the right-wing populists that he is an acceptable place, Ron DeSantis has to be dangerous. He has to appear dangerous in order to be an acceptable alternative to Donald Trump. You agree?
You made your way back.
Yeah. Never in doubt.
He has to be.
Never in doubt.
He has to be hostile to them.
He has to look dangerous so that he can make his bones with the MAGA and MAGA adjacent communities.
What do we have next here?
More excellence, I assume.
Oh.
It's already in there. It's in the document.
That was Colin.
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 Woo. You may smell like greasy wood smoke, but you, sir.
Wonderful.
Colin says it's not him, by the way. He says, but I know that he rode his canoe here after setting a small fire on Roosevelt Island and cooking breakfast over an open flame this morning. I know how he lives.
Okay.
From an alert reader who has a subscription to Bloomberg Extra Special stuff. Emily Wilkins for Bloomberg Government. Now, do you recall the name of the freshman congresswoman from Illinois who complained about not having to share a row house?
Oh, yes. Last week. I forget the name, though. That's exactly
yes, but
what
she's the first
me.
Female Hispanic from a Midwestern state to throw left-handed
yes.
or whatever.
Yeah,
yeah whatever her first was. But anyway, here's the headline from Bloomberg. Lawmaker reimbursement plan praised as helping less affluent House members. House members can now be reimbursed for lodging, food, change expected to bring more economic diversity to the House. Betcha it doesn't. Betcha a bajillion dollars, Emily Wilkins, that it does not bring more economic diversity to the House. Current and former lawmakers greeted a new policy that would reimburse them for lodging, meals, and incidentals while in D.C. with cautious praise, saying it would ensure that those from all economic backgrounds can serve in Congress. Geez, Louise. The details of the new policy, which the House Administration Committee approved at the end of last year, are still being developed, and some members said they are not aware of the change. Pay raises have been a toxic topic for lawmakers, worried that such extra compensation could become grist for their opponents on the campaign trail. The last time Congress had a cost of living adjustment, it was 2009. While the $174,000 salary for the rank and file member is far above the average American's wages, members have to often keep a residence in both their district and the nation's capital, which is one of the most expensive areas of the country. Oh, no. Brett Guthrie, RKY.
This is so white people problems.
Brett Guthrie, RKY, who joined Congress in 2009, said the lack of any cost of living adjustments means it's far easier for a wealthier person to come to Washington. Oh, no. It's getting...
Wait. It is? Are you saying our lawmakers are disproportionately wealthy?
And old? What? Brett Guthrie, it's getting tougher for middle-class people to serve here. No, it's never been easy, Brett. Congressman Guthrie. He said it's good to have some wealthy members, but that, quote, if you want a good mix, you got to have people who are able to live here and live at home. Representative Haley Stevens, D-Mish, said she knows people who wanted to run for Congress but didn't think they could afford it. We've got to build equity, she said. It's really important to show that anyone can come here and serve. Lord, if we haven't shown that anyone can be in Congress by now, I don't know. What do they need to do? Like, just be Buster Bluth? I mean, gracious sakes. While members could save thousands on hotels and meals through the reimbursements, there are limits. Like other government employees who travel for work, members will be capped at the General Services Administration per diem rates, according to a senior congressional aides. Under those limits, check this out. Under those limits, members would be reimbursed up to $258 a day for hotels, rentals, or other housing, depending on the month. Members who own a home in D.C. are out of luck. The reimbursements can't cover mortgages. For meals and other incidentals, members would be reimbursed $79 a day. So it goes on, and my favorite is from Citizens Against Government Waste spokesman Alexandra Schatz Abrams said the group sees the change as a way to give members more flexibility and is on par with private sector standards. The important thing, she said in an emailed statement, is, quote, greater transparency for taxpayers on how each member is spending his money. No doubt giving them $258 a day pocket money will result in much greater transparency and all of that stuff. And Reed Ribble, Republican from Wisconsin, said, closes, former Republican member, it's outrageous. Members have not had a pay raise since 2009. If you worked for an employer for 12 or 13 years and never got a raise in pay, you'd kind of think your boss sucked. Hey, Congressman Ribble, you're your own boss. You set the pay rate for Congress. You member, when you were in the House, you could have proposed legislation to increase your pay. If you think that your boss sucks, you're your own boss. So bad luck for you. You're self-employed. I cannot tell you. I think the House should be representative. I think all of that is true. But for most people, when we are young, and this goes to the guy who couldn't get an apartment at the Wharf because of his bad credit rating.
Oh, yeah.
If you have not established a good credit rating, maybe running for Congress is not for you yet. Maybe you should wait. If these are the considerations that you have about serving in Congress, and again, I say this as a person who favors a congressional dorm. I want a congressional dorm. I have a solution for all of this. Put them in a dorm, build a dormitory over right there behind the Hart Senate office building. Buy two blocks there and put in dormitory, put a gym in there, whatever. Live it up.
They have a gym.
Well, they do have nice gyms. That is true. But
they
anyway.
They don't need a gym.
But give them a Frogger game. Put whatever you want.
I loved that game.
Are you old enough Are you old enough to remember when they had ashtrays on video games?
Yes.
Yes, bolted so that guys with mullets could be playing Galaga while they were smoking their Winstons. Welcome to the Burger Chef National Road 1983 America. Anyway, this is my new favorite thing. I just am delighted by members of Congress complaining about how hard it is to be in Congress. And I know it's true. I know lots of members who sleep in their rooms. I know lots of members for whom this is hardship.
This is Chris's like passion in life is.
I know that it's hardship. I know people, families suffer for members going. You choose to run. right? You choose to run. I'm not saying we shouldn't make it a lot better. There's a lot of reforms that I'd like to have. But a $258 per diem so that they can stay in hotel rooms in addition to their salary is not the correct answer, okay? Boo.
When you end an item boo, it's always a good item. As this next one will be.
Oh, the great Meghan McArdle, yeah.
This gas stove thing was amazing. Amazing. Hit us, Chris.
Well, no, this Meghan McArdle already did the heavy lifting. Our friend and great columnist at the Washington Post, Meghan McArdle, helpfully put into summation a story. Now, when you first saw the gas stove story cross, did you, as I did, know what this really was?
Well, I have been following the issue because for a long time, there's been a movement to
totally
get these out in to eliminate them in new buildings in cities for a long time.
Yes.
Around the country. And I've been
following
this.
Please tell listeners what the complaint about gas stoves is.
Well, this was interesting because they've been the argument that I've seen is we need to do this for environmental reasons.
But
and
there
this
are also,
time,
yeah.
I was not privy to this. So now the argument, the leading argument that Richard Trumka made when he said, we're going to get rid of these, was for health reasons. Like kids are getting asthma from these, the whatever is emitted from the gas stoves is bad for your health. So they led with the
former head of the United Mine Workers of America says, it's these gas, it's natural gas. The problem. No, not saying there's any connection there, but clean burning coal, let's get clean burning coal back in people's homes. Anyway.
Okay.
When I saw, because the spam bots have found my AEI address, because I have now been put on every list for every news and quasi news outlet, I woke up one day and it was like, the right wing ones were Biden administration coming for gas stoves. And I looked at it and I thought, I don't even know what this is, but I'll bet you somebody said something stupid and it's going to be, Ted Cruz was of every, each life cycle of one of these kinds of stories has to include Ted Cruz, where he found a video, when I say him, of course, not him, someone who works for him, found a video that Joe Biden was in cooking with a gas, on a gas range. She was cooking with someone in a segment and was sauteing something on a gas range, and Ted Cruz posted it with the phrase, rules for thee, but not for me. And I was like, just isn't it time for you to go to Cancun again? Isn't it about the season of the year where you head south, Senator? So this turns into this whole, like, you know the Biden administration's coming for your stoves. As Meghan points out, it took a pitifully long time for the Biden administration to come out and say, that was something Richard Trumka said for a second. We are not doing this. This is not going to happen. But it exploded, no pun intended. It's one of those stories where the left and the right both have to hurry to get their, and I do mean this pun, hot takes in before the story evaporates, right? You have to like race to get your dumb angle or tweet out on this before the story finally is kaput. Read Meghan McArdle.
We have the Kraken COVID strain.
Oh, yeah, the other Kraken. What's her name? The lawyer? Sydney
Powell.
Sydney Powell failed to copyright Kraken and should have. So how we cover COVID. So one of the ways that we should not cover COVID is to raise unnecessary alarms about COVID. We should talk about it in frank ways, but we should not raise unnecessary alarms. Like possibly naming a strain the Kraken strain, for example. Of all of the things that you might do, maybe don't call it the Kraken strain. You're like, it must be very deadly if it's named after a giant mythological squid that emerges from the ocean to crush your ship in its tentacles. How is it? And you're like, oh, it's actually not very deadly. It's another mutation that is highly contagious, well, but not more deadly.
You'll be relieved to hear I'm not worried about it, but...
But just the desire to scaremonger around the story, even as the pandemic passes into hindsight.
I would say yes, but the media, the name is stupid, but the media has a desire to scaremonger around any COVID
of
story,
course, anything.
So this is just like the easiest way.
Right. The Kraken just making it too easy.
Chris, this next story was like chef's kiss because actually I want to look at my phone because a message came through this morning. This story, which is survey finds in the Washington Post, survey finds classical fascist anti-Semitic views widespread in U.S. from the Washington Post. There, a message came through because the way it showed up on their website this morning was as follows. There was breaking news in the Post. Centuries old anti-Jewish stereotypes still widely held in U.S., said survey. You know, okay, the quote from the piece is, it is difficult to assess whether anti-Semitic views have increased over time given changes in the survey's response options as well as how respondents were sampled. The survey was conducted in September and October, blah, blah, blah. You know, what bugs me about this kind of stuff is that it's not so much the sentiment. Like, anti-Semitism is endemic to the human condition. Like, bigotry, prejudice, hatred. It really is, what we can measure are the actions people take downstream of it. Like, are incidents related to it?
Yes.
Higher or lower? These sentiments are not going away. Ever.
Well, so my, as I come to this as a Gentile, but a pollster. So I'm not a pollster, but a, you know what I mean. A person who's into political demography and polling. And here is the first. So this is a survey that the Anti-Defamation League, I'm a little unclear, but it seems like the Anti-Defamation League had previously done surveys like this, but this one is done in conjunction with the Post. I can't quite, I'm sure I could find it if I read more closely, but anyway, here's the top percent. Sizable shares of Americans believe anti-Jewish stereotypes. Percent of adults saying it is mostly true or somewhat true that Jews. And number one, 70% stick together more than other Americans. I think that's true. Isn't that true?
I think so.
I think that's very true. And I don't want to be, and I my eldest man-child taught me this term, philo-Semitic. To be philo-Semitic is to be, to dig it, to be into it. Be like an Anglophile, but philo-Semitic instead of anti-Semitic. One of the things that I admire most about Jews, Jewish Americans, strong family, stick together, take care of each other, strong community value. That's a great, that's one of the great attributes that compared to the Goisha masses who are living atomized lives, Jews make family a priority. I don't think that's anti-Semitic. Is that anti-Semitic?
No.
Okay, I didn't think so. Now, the one at the end, 16%.
Next, you're going to tell us they prioritize education?
Yes, exactly, prioritize education. 16% are not as honest as other business people. 17% not warm and friendly. Who said not warm and friendly?
Dude, we're all the opposite.
Come on, the hugs. Have lots of irritating faults, 19%. I mean, everyone. Are more
gotta
willing,
cop to that.
Are more willing than others to use shady practices to get what they want, 20%. Have too much power in the United States. So basically, there's consistent answers in the 20s. What are the most damaging one is are more loyal to or the one with the highest percentage, 39%, are more loyal to Israel than America. That's concerning, right? Because that is anti-Semitic. And 38% always like to be at the head of things, as opposed to everyone else who just likes to follow, always like to be at the head of things. Anyway, I think this is, I think the fact that 20% of Americans seem to reliably hold pretty strongly anti-Semitic views is concerning and disappointing. But to your point, I think it's consistent. I think that's just, that's always the way it is. And that's why groups like that have to be vigilant. Is that fair?
Absolutely.
Kanye West did not invent anti-Semitism.
Yeah. Okay. And now we come to our, well, this is the item before our style section, but certainly the saddest item of the week, which is the death of Politico's, and as of lately, I know him as Politico's because my editor, when I was at Politico, Blake Hounshell, which has gotten lots and lots and lots of coverage, but very, very, very sad. And I can attest to, we're going to link his Times obituary, but I can attest to the fact that he was incredibly talented editor And I will say that, you know, being an editor, it is a real talent to make something better without, like, changing somebody's voice.
Yes, yes.
And Blake could really do that. And a lot of people have said that, like, he had an eye for the weird, the obscure, and, like, a mischievousness and quirkiness that, like, makes news coverage fun.
I was going to say, I love the people who talked about his emphasis on making stories fun and finding the interesting angle and doing the stuff.
An eye for detail and angles.
I knew him a little bit. I'm very sorry for everyone, for the loss that you and all the people who worked with him have felt, and certainly for his family. He was a pro. I found him super easy to deal with, super easy to have a, I won't say friendship, but a collegial relationship with. He was a pro, and I admired his work. His politics note was useful. I read every one.
For some reason, I remember him telling me at one point when, I can't remember what it was. I think I was in Vietnam covering Trump's meeting with Kim, but like somehow it was like they were holding us all on a bus, and like it was just a total cluster. And I mean, nothing happened at these meetings, right. And Blake saying like you need to get better at writing in like a lighter tone, which like for news coverage of the Trump White House was like not that common. Everything was like heavy and dramatic, and like I remember that feedback, and it was so true. And then also like I do think that this like you know goes to show, because he committed suicide, like how people can have like this. Incredibly dazzling intellect and so much talent. And there's, of course, we know, like, you know, a great artists and poets and musicians. And then there's, like, you know, just so much complexity underneath, like, the exterior that you see.
You know, the Anthony Bourdain syndrome.
Yeah.
Where other people look from the outside and think, and, you know, mental illness does not respect those differences. And I would, you know, I know it's corny to say, but I think worth saying, if you have those feelings, say it out loud. Right. Say it up. Find somebody you trust. Find somebody.
Chris knows that. I have no issue with that.
I have had issues in my life, not this issue, but where, you know, things get bigger when you don't say them. So you got to have somebody where you can say them. You have to, if you're a therapist, but a clergyman, a trusted friend, say stuff out loud, name the dragon, and the dragon gets smaller. Don't let it live rent free. Start air it out in there.
And that brings us to our style section, which, Chris, these were like chef's kiss. I did think it was funny how much coverage this got, which is the closure of the restaurant. What city is it in?
Copenhagen. Copenhagen, please.
Copenhagen.
Yes, please.
Noma, which I actually knew about this guy and his name because I've like seen documentaries about him where they serve like a reindeer heart with pine needles on a plate, and he's like a complete slave driver, and people travel to Copenhagen just to eat at this restaurant. The restaurant's called Noma, and the closure of this restaurant, the guy basically said, like, this is not sustainable. People are like putting stuff on plates with tweezers. And
let me read the great lead. You know, Frank Bruni, who has worn many hats at the New York Times over the years, but theater critic, blah, but Frank Bruni is at his best writing about restaurants and food. Quote, I was at Noma. It was at Noma that I ate the most unsettling meal of my life. The most unsettling dish, I should say, though dish doesn't feel right given that it wriggled and twitched. Quote, you'll never taste a fresher shrimp in your life, the server who presented it to me promised, telling me to plop it in my mouth. But I was as frozen as it was fresh. When he returned minutes later, it was still moving, more slowly. It's going to die soon, he said, in the tone of a priest administering last rites. It might as well die for its intended purpose. All these years later, I have a vivid memory of how fast and hard I chomped down on it, lest it perk up and treadmill on my tongue. I have no recollection of the flavor. There's a metaphor here, and it applies not just to Noma, the Copenhagen restaurant that had stunned the world this week with an announcement that it would close for regular service at the end of next year. Get your reservations for $10,000 right now, please. You have only one more year to eat reindeer heart and live shrimp.
Yeah.
But to other internationally renowned, ardently coveted temples of gastronomy that are forever trying to dazzle self-regarding epicures with new stunts, novel sensations, modes of presentations that we hadn't imagined, flora and fauna rarely pinned down on a plate. And he goes on from there, and it's There was one Il Bulli in, was it in Sevilla? But it was, Spain was the epicenter of, okay, of this kind of global, you know, a mousse, a foam, it's on fire, eat it upside down, 27 spoons in a row. Washington, D.C. has mini bar and bar mini and other of these kinds of pay $1,500.
Well, the one in New York was per se.
Yeah, per se.
It was, you can, it's only a tasting restaurant and it's like 20 courses and blah, blah, blah.
So let me recommend.
Never
here,
been there.
Just to prove what a you know what I am. In Washington, D.C., Gravitas in Ivy City.
I got married there.
You got married at Gravitas?
Yes.
I love Gravitas.
Well, it was during COVID, and so this was like our backup to a backup plan where we could like rent out the whole thing.
Fabulous.
And it was great.
It's a great facility. I recommend it highly. And you can have one of these.
It was amazing.
You can have one of these kinds of meals, not for $1,500.
Yes, we did not have a tasting menu at our wedding.
But the I bet it was a blast.
It was amazing. They did a fabulous job.
But yes, the Noma closes, restaurant critics' hardest hit.
Yes.
Is our takeaway.
Chris, that brings us to our obsessions of the week.
Yes.
Where we break down the stories that we can't get out of our heads. And since I'm the more obsessive of the two, although you were very obsessive about, your gas stove thing.
No, the living arrangements.
The living arrangements. Yes. I have been obsessed. I was obsessed with the media over and over and over again, saying how the Brazilian rioters were inspired by January 6th and how this was like exactly the same as January 6th. And so this happened on January 8th. And it was like, you know, January 6th, the 2nd. And CNN's Jim Sciutto, again, to the Chris Lick, do you have a problem, said, is election denialism a new U.S. export?
Is election denialism a new U.S. export?
As if, like, these guys are going to be shocked to learn about the storming of the Bastille. As if, like, you know, political unrest and disputing elections started in America on January 6th. Guys.
And I can tell you, it wasn't just CNN.
What a case of presentism.
I was lucky enough, I got to have breakfast with the pony this week, the day after this happened. And she put Morning Joe on. And it was just wall-to-wall Brazil coverage. And Steve Bannon has never gotten more attention than that day. It was just like clips of Steve Bannon, clips of Steve Bannon and all of this stuff. So, yes, you're quite right.
Okay.
That's
that was
it?
Mine. Yeah.
It's a very light. You were very lightly obsessed.
I think that was like the nub of it.
That was the nub.
Yeah.
I would say Americans should be alarmed. Brazil had a military junta in command until like 1988. As a matter of fact, Bolsonaro was part of it, right? Bolsonaro wanted to bring the military rule back to Brazil. And as a matter of fact, the people who were in Brasilia, and by the way, some modern architecture is great, but the failure of Brasilia as a city continues to delight me just as a whatever. Sorry, cheap shot. Sorry, Brazil, cheap shot. But the protesters in Brasilia, when the military arrived, they thought, oh, good, the junta is back. The military cabal is back to take over. So deeply rooted in Brazil's history. What you should think as an American, you should think whatever you want. What I thought as an American was, we surely can't be like Brazil, right? This should be like a warning to us. This should be an object there, but for the grace of God, go we. Let our experience on January 6th have been a brief dabbling with this kind of developing nation horse crap and not the future. Okay, I obsess?
Yep.
Okay, my obsession is really mean, and I'm sorry in advance.
For once.
But I have had it with baby boomer coverage. I have had it with the baby boomer coverage. I have had it. And this week, we'll start with the bad. Here is a clip.
We're making vibrators for women with arthritis.
Yes, vibrators.
Brilliant.
Grace!
How could this not be entertaining? Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin are Grace and Frankie, two feisty octogenarians who see old age not as a death sentence, but as a victory lap.
I'm an 80-year-old woman, and I've earned the right to take my sweet time.
That's my girl.
In the show, the two women became friends only after their husbands, played by Martin Sheen and Sam Waterston, reveal that they're in love with each other.
So all I can tell you is, gross, dude. And I was shocked to find out, do you know that they had a sexy old lady show that Lily Tomlin?
No.
So they had a sexy old lady show, and now they're making a sexy old lady movie, or they've made a sexy old lady movie, where they're hot for Tom Brady. And
I could get down with that.
I don't. You're not helping. You're not helping. It's called like 80 for Brady or something gross. And this, Jane Fonda, my ire about this is deepened by the fact that Netflix thinks I'm an old person, which they should, based on what I'm watching. They should think that I am 80, but recommended to me a movie about sexy time with Robert Redford and Jane Fonda, where it's like, we're both too good looking to not be sexually active with each other. Let us do so. You're like, can we stop? Can people stop having to be sexy in their 80s? Surely if you live to 80, you no longer have to have facelifts and jazzercise and do all of these things and be sex positive. Surely you could just prepare to die and that would be good enough. But not,
ouch,
not baby boomers.
What if you're living till 100?
Don't make a movie about it. Promise, I don't care if you go when you're 80 on sex tourism to Tampa Bay. I hope you do. I hope that it works great. But, clear it with Patrick, but the problem here is making movies and putting it on TV. Every week, CBS Sunday Morning always has one part of it that is like, hey, boomers, it's the 50th anniversary of a time you did drugs in public one place. Do you remember that? Oh, yeah, it's so great. So the boomers, as you know, are disproportionately represented in news consumers because young people don't consume news.
Yeah. Well, they do on like TikTok.
Yeah, in 8 seconds, in memes and dances. But so here's another one, not to harp on CBS News too much, but here is, do you know who Paul Ehrlich is?
Oh, yeah.
So Paul Ehrlich, I've been wrong many times, but no one has been as wrong as effulgently, or very few people have been wronger than Paul Ehrlich and his 1968 book, The Population Bomb. Here's econ blogger Noah Smith. Biologist Paul Ehrlich is one of the most discredited popular intellectuals in America. He's so discredited that his Wikipedia page starts the second paragraph with, Ehrlich became well known for the discredited 1968 book, The Population Bomb. In that book, he predicted that hundreds of millions of people would starve to death in the decade to come, when no such thing happened in the 70s or ever so far. Ehrlich's name became sort of a household joke among the news reading set. And yet, despite all this, in the year 2022, 60 Minutes still had Ehrlich on to offer his thoughts on wildlife loss. When the news program was roundly ridiculed for giving Ehrlich airtime, the 90-year-old scholar defended himself on Twitter by citing his academic credentials and the fact that the population bomb had been peer-reviewed. And CBS 60 Minutes had Paul Ehrlich. I don't know what the equivalent, it would be like having Sidney Powell on,
yeah,
to talk about election law. Like, what are you talking about? This guy was told, he was beclowned with his forecasts about what was going to happen to human life on Earth. And they had him back because it's all part of this nostalgia thing. And here is the last piece. New York Times. Who wrote this? I want to make sure that I give it to the right person. I'm sometimes neglectful, and I'm sorry every time I am. Ben Castleman, good piece, writes this. Many boomers put off retiring. In 2019, just before the pandemic, 57% of Americans in their early 60s were still working, compared with 46% of that age group 2 decades earlier. Improved health and shifting industry patterns, more jobs in offices, fewer in factories, played a role. So did sheer financial necessity. The housing bust and stock market collapse left many people without enough savings for retirement. Instead of dropping, the share of workers and job seekers leveled off starting in about 2014, then began to rise slowly toward the end of the decade. It's a long piece that explains that the reason we have one of the big reasons we have a labor shortage. Did you know about this?
No.
One of the big reasons for the labor shortage is baby boomers not retiring, not creating the space for people to move up, and how this goes. The importance of baby boomers is hard to overstate. Virtually all of the growth in the labor force between the end of the Great Recession and the start of the pandemic a decade later came from workers 55 and older. Whoa, right? So baby boomers won't retire. Baby boomers will not stop talking about having sex with Jane Fonda on television. I'm a Gen X. I'm a member of Gen X, and you're a millennial, right?
I'm a millennial. Yes.
So here's the thing. The millennial cohort is now larger in the American electorate, which is what I study. Your cohort is now larger than the baby boomers. But in news and media and advertising, baby boomers are still way bigger in terms of what kind of disposable income. You know that the most desirable folks are a little bit older than both of us, because that's when you people have disposable income. So why you see,
right?
It's like when you pull up next to a nice sports car, who's driving that nice sports car?
Like a 60-year-old,
right?
Man.
A 65-year-old guy who's like,
that's
I can.
That's Joe Biden's Corvette.
That's Joe Biden. He keeps it locked up.
Yeah,
keeps it locked up. That's also some copper wire he stole.
Exactly.
So I know part of this is just economics. I know part of whatever, but like, hey, media, sucking up to the baby boomers so constantly and talking about their sex lives and doing all of this stuff. Enough. As a member of Gen X, the forgotten generation, I just say, let's move on, please.
Chris, that brings us to my favorite time of the week, which is reader mail. And our first letter is from both of our former colleague, Alicia Acuna. Alicia Acuna, right?
Alicia Acuna.
She says, hi, wretches. Journalism isn't dying. It's just crying. Thought you'd enjoy this one from the Denver Post. Love your podcast oh so much. And she sends the best spots to cry in Denver with or without company. It is amazing. Unfortunately, this article is paywalled, so I cannot get to it.
This is from the Denver Post.
Okay. She says, workout and yoga studios are highly public places, but given that the emotional component of exercise can often feel overwhelming this time of year, they work too. Whether it's the walk-in freezer at your job, we don't have one of those, or a darkened shower in your home, there's no wrong way to do it. Just be sure to give yourself the option because you'll feel better afterward.
Thanks, Denver Post.
I am not sure my boss would agree.
First of all, this is a safe space for crying if you want to. Thanks to Alicia. That's great. I love that. And it's good to hear from you. And I'm glad you sent that in. I hope all is well. We should catch up. But wow, workout and yoga studios. Where do you like to, do you have a place to have a good cry?
First of all, like, I don't plan my cries. So it's kind of like any place where I happen to be when the moment hits. And my husband hates this. I had like a breakdown at some cafe in Big Sky, Montana. And he, you know, I do not care about crying in public, but he was like, everybody's looking at you. Yeah.
Gentiles.
Yeah. He's Jewish now.
Oh, that is true. That is true.
He is a Jew. So he should become totally.
He should embrace his more emotion. The big-hearted emotionality.
Yes. So I cannot, like, this planning will not help me at all, because I cannot plan my cries. They just come to me.
So you need to be more intentional with your crying and figure
I
out
do not. I that will
drop
never
a
work
shower
for me.
Bomb in and really get open your sinus
this
passages.
Will never work for me. Okay.
Okay, up next.
Up next, we have a letter from Keith in Indiana, who writes, Eliana and Chris, I was wondering if you could discuss the move by Eli Saslow from the Washington Post to the New York Times, paired with Jonathan Swan's move to the Times. They are two of the bigger hires there in recent memory. Obviously, this is the latest in a long line of staff moves between the two papers, which is an interesting topic on its own. And given Saslow's decorated career, it drew plenty of reaction from WAPO staffers.
Pulitzer Prize winner,
okay.
Eli Saslow.
But even as skilled and talented as Saslow is, I'm unaware that he ever made an omelet in his underwear in front of surprise contractors.
Whoa.
He's no Chris Steierwald.
Whoa. I forget that sometimes I overshare here. I'm glad that wasn't on video.
Okay.
I was surprised.
I
the contractors weren't surprised. I was surprised.
You know, we've talked on this podcast about how things are not that great. Chris is still cracking up.
That's so good. Keith from Indiana, you scamp.
Things are not all that great at the Washington Post. They are not great financially. There's tension between the publisher, Fred Ryan, and the editor, Sally Busby. And, you know, the fish rots from the head. Like, that stuff trickles down. And so I think you do see talent. Talent feels that. And, like, they pick up and take their wares elsewhere. And, you know, running a news site, like, talent is hard to find. These people are incredibly valuable, the really, really good people. So, of course, the Times is eager to gobble these people up. And I attribute this to the Post being in a bad place right now. It wasn't always, and I'm sure that will change, but that is what I attribute this to.
I really like Saslow's writing, and his book about presidential speeches was excellent, so... Congratulations, New York Times. You treat yourself to an underwear omelet.
Chris, and that brings us to your favorite item of the week, which I think we already did with that Bloomberg article about.
Yeah, I'll count that as my.
Yes, totally.
I'll count that. I took my favorite early.
But when I am forced to say something nice. And, okay, is that actually going to be your favorite?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I fear that mine is almost too obvious, but mine is a New York Times piece by Vimal Patel published on Sunday, January 8th.
Oh my gosh, yes.
And this article was wonderful. It was about a lecturer at Hamline University, which is in St. Paul, where I'm from, who was pushed out after she showed a painting in an art history class of the Prophet Muhammad, which Muslim students don't believe the images of the Prophet should be shown.
It is haram to show any image of the Prophet, even this one, which is very flattering, and she was showing as it was not...
It's a historical artifact.
Yeah, it was not like a Charlie Hebdo cartoon mocking Muhammad.
And by the way, she gave a warning to students in the class saying she was going to do this. And, I mean, my response to this was that the article's wonderful and you should read it, was like, do they serve pork in the dining halls because, you know... The Jewish religion prohibits the consumption of pork and shellfish.
With Muslims.
The mixing of meat and milk. And if so, like, you know, how can we let this stand? And this was totally ridiculous. And
here's a great paragraph. Officials, is it Hamline or Hamline?
Hamline.
Hamline would be also a better name if they were serving pork. Officials at Hamline, a small private university in St. Paul, Minnesota, with about 1,800 undergraduates, had tried to douse what they feared would become a runaway fire. Instead, they ended up with what they had tried to avoid, a national controversy which pitted advocates of academic liberty and free speech against Muslims who believe that showing the image of the Prophet Muhammad, uppercase P, is always sacrilegious. Good job.
Okay. Well, that is all the time that we have left today for the news about the news. If you have a story that you want us to talk about, please email us at wretches@nebulouspodcasts.com. That's wretches@nebulouspodcasts.com.
Oh, and one other thing they should send to Inkstained Wretches. If anybody wants to run my Twitter account, I need a new Twitter person to run my Twitter account. Send your email there to wretches@nebulouspodcasts.com. That could be fun.
Are you being serious?
Yeah, totally serious.
Okay. This has been Inkstained Wretches from Nebulous Media, produced by Colin Ciccola.
Woot woot.
Find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and leave us no less than a 5-star review. Just search for Wretches.